In the dead of night, the merchant ship, the SS Ettrick, weighs anchor and slips silently from port in Liverpool. It's the 2nd of July, 1940, and Britain is at war with Germany. The ship is packed with 2,600 men, more than twice the number it's designed to accommodate. Half are immigrants and refugees who came to the UK to escape the fascists on the continent. They've now been labelled enemy aliens by a paranoid British government and are headed for an internment camp in case they turn out to be Nazi spies. The other half are German and Italian prisoners of war. In other words, the very fascists the immigrants are fleeing from. The men have a perilous crossing ahead of them. They're destined for Canada, but Nazi U-boats are harassing the North Atlantic. Just days earlier, the Ettrick's sister ship, the Arandora Star, was torpedoed, killing more than half of those on board. And now, on the Ettrick, every groan of the hull brings cries of terror. One of the internees on board is the brilliant atomic physicist Klaus Fuchs. Another is Hans Kahler, top spy recruiter for the Soviet Union. From the BBC World Service, I'm Rosa Ellis, and this is season two of The Bomb. Episode 2, A Split Life. Klaus Fuchs's voyage on the SS Ettrick is a cruel twist of fate. Since his arrival in the UK, he's enjoyed peace, stability, and life as a flourishing academic among some of the brightest minds in maths and physics. Having fled Nazi persecution in 1934, he secured a place to study his PhD at Bristol University. For men like Fuchs, these are exciting times.
In the 1920s and 30s, the field of quantum mechanics and nuclear physics was just emerging. It was the most exciting discipline to study, and it attracted the best minds in physics from really all over the world.
Cindy Kelly is the founder and president of the Atomic Heritage Foundation.
The universities in Europe, the United States, recognized that this was going to change the world. It was going to change how we produced energy for the future. So everyone was eager to learn about this.
For a non-scientist like me, quantum mechanics seems to confound all reason. It doesn't obey the same logic as the rest of the world. This subatomic universe is defined by degrees of uncertainty and understood by mathematical probability. But it's a world Fuchs is at home in.
Klaus Fuchs was a brilliant theorist. He was a brilliant mathematician. And he was willing to work on interesting problems. He wasn't stuck with, you know, accepting what he was taught, but kind of asked the question, well, how can I apply this? He was a magnet. He was recognized right away for his brilliance.
Fuchs is a rising star amongst the science fraternity, but his old life in Germany still haunts him. When his German passport expires, he applies for a renewal, but the Nazi Gestapo declines. They have some intel they think the British authorities will be interested in. He is, they say, a notorious communist. The police chief constable in Bristol receives the report and opens it on his desk. It contains details of Klaus's role as a student communist agitator. He raises an eyebrow and ponders what to do next. The Gestapo are hardly a reliable source, but he certainly can't just ignore it. He informs Britain's intelligence services, but with a caveat. He says,
here in Bristol, we have no information that he's doing anything he shouldn't. He's perfectly fine. He's not doing any political activities, and he seems to be quite all right. So he put that in this message to MI5 that he was this notorious communist, but then said, but, you know, while he's here, he's fine.
Klaus Fuchs is none the wiser to any of this, but he can thank the chief constable for not taking a closer look. Because he's wrong, very wrong. Communism, the Soviet Union, and Stalin are all viewed with deep suspicion by many within the British establishment.
We must support our comrades in Spain. Inaction is not an option.
In Bristol, Fuchs joins the University Socialist Society. He joins a committee supporting the Republican side of the Spanish Civil War. And he helps found the Society for the Cultural Relationship between the peoples of the British Commonwealth and the USSR. He is devout and restless in his political activism. But this isn't uncommon. Socialism and communism are popular ideas, and the Soviet Union is widely respected as a defence against the rising tide of fascism. Fuchs is among a growing community of émigré scientists in the UK who've seen Hitler's oppression up close and personal.
Many of the people who were studying in Germany in the 20s and 30s found they were no longer welcome once Hitler came to power and began his anti-Semitic policies.
Each year, the noose around the neck of anyone who had some Jewish ancestry was tightened with a series of restrictions.
Restrictions on their movement, on their occupations, and finally on their lives. This anti-Semitic policy rounded up Jews, as we know, as part of this horrific Holocaust. It also rounded up people who were not true supporters of the Nazi regime. And this included liberals and anti-Nazi communists and anyone else that stepped out of line. So there was a huge exodus of this very top talented nuclear physicists and their disciples, and they fled for their lives.
Among this tide of German émigrés arriving on British shores is Max Born. He is to quantum physics what Marx is to communism. Throughout the early 20th century, he turned the German University of Göttingen into the global epicentre of quantum physics. He was the intellectual father figure to the who's who of upcoming atomic scientists. Werner Heisenberg, Enrico Fermi, J. Robert Oppenheimer. You name it, they all cut their teeth under him. But he's a left-leaning pacifist, so the Nazis kick him out. He settles in Edinburgh and sets about recruiting fresh talent. On the first damp, cold day of the autumn semester in 1937, Max Born descends the stairs into the basement of the old Edinburgh infirmary and walks along the corridor to his office. It's a large, dark room, and beside his desk and chair is a rectangular table surrounded by chairs that have been sitting empty for the past year. But not today. On this morning, Born is met with the faces of his two new graduate students. One is Walter Kellermann, a German experimental physicist, son of a rabbi. And the other is Klaus Fuchs, a German theoretician, son of a Lutheran minister.
Max Born saw everything in pictures. He visualised everything.
But Klaus Fuchs is cut from different cloth.
He saw everything in mathematical formula.
They complement each other perfectly. Fuchs works on quantum dynamics, statistical mechanics, and the theory of the atomic nuclei. He produces reams of mathematical formula, exploring the most complex riddles of atomic science.
Some of my work had sprung from my old ideas. But at the same time, with Max Born, I was in a wonderful collaboration with an outstanding scientist and wonderful person. It was a partnership, you could say, in which I was the junior partner, but Max Born also felt it as a partnership.
Born and his wife embrace Fuchs as an extended member of the family. He befriends their children, plays bridge with them in the evenings, and is often found working in their home. As well as being a pioneer in quantum physics, Born is an accomplished pianist, and he runs an informal chamber group for mathematician and physicist musicians. Klaus Fuchs plays second violin, badly. But Born can forgive Fuchs's dodgy music skills.
He loved working with him because he was very smart, very clever. He described him as weak in appearance, but with a powerful brain, taciturn, with a veiled expression which disclosed nothing of his thoughts. Born's older daughter, Irena, described him more practically as a person who needed a warm coat and a good meal.
Perceptions can be deceptive. Klaus Fuchs may be introverted and opaque, but he is devout in his politics and makes no bones about it. He bores the Born children with his communist sermonising. Max Born is sympathetic to his politics, and he doesn't mind it in the home, but he doesn't want Fuchs bringing any trouble to his door, so he tells it to him straight.
I don't want to hear any of that. You know, I don't want you out in the streets. I don't want you leafletting. No propaganda, no communism. And Klaus, for the most part, agreed with that and followed it.
For the most part, but not completely. This is where my family comes in. In London lives my great uncle, Jürgen Kaczynski, brother to Ursula, the spy. Jürgen is a budding young economist and the leading figure among communists who have fled the continent to the UK. He is incredibly well-connected, rubbing shoulders with leading Labour politicians in the war cabinet, trade unionists, academics and socialites. He works tirelessly, building links between leftists from tip to toe of the United Kingdom and disseminating pro-communist propaganda. And he needs to get some of that propaganda back to mainland Europe.
They would get things printed and get this material to Klaus, and he would put it on a ship he'd found ships that were take it and they would go and bring it to the continent because Edinburgh is a port and it was easy for him to be able to do that. And nobody ever saw him do this. It was all undercover and he got away with it without any trouble.
And so is this the first time he comes into contact with my family, with Jürgen Kaczynski?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure that they knew each other in Berlin.
Really?
They all knew each other. There was no secret here.
So now I've discovered that it wasn't just Ursula who had a link to Klaus Fuchs. Actually, her brother knew him first, and even before they were all in the UK. Their lives were even more entwined than I realised. Klaus Fuchs is tackling maths at the forefront of quantum physics and secretly collaborating with my great-uncle to smuggle communist propaganda to mainland Europe. At the same time, another German emigre physicist in the UK is working on a problem that will change the world as we know it.
My father was quiet, very modest. He always worked in his study. He was always in his study. He went into his study and there was this thick wall of cigarette smoke. And somewhere beyond that cigarette smoke there he was doing his work.
Joe Hookway's father, Rudolf Piles, was a German Jew and a brilliant physicist. He was avuncular, warm and well-liked.
He had a very dry sense of humour. He took pleasure in words and sort of ambiguities. He was just quiet and gentle, never saw him get angry. My mother got angry all the time, but he was he didn't get angry as far as I can remember.
When war first broke out, Piles was already in the UK. He was distraught for Europe, but relieved to be away from the worst of the fighting. Soon, though, his brilliant scientific brain would put him at the centre of the British war effort.
At the beginning, when my father was a refugee arriving in England, there was a limit to the kind of work he could be involved with, because he was considered to be an enemy alien, and therefore there was a restriction on the kind of things that he could do.
At this point, everyone believes the balance of the war hangs on technologies like radar and anti-aircraft artillery. They are deemed far too sensitive to have German scientists working on them. So Piles, not the type of man to sit around doing nothing, teams up with another emigre scientist, Otto Frisch, in Birmingham.
And that's when they came up with the idea of investigating what would be involved in producing the bomb.
It's almost ironic, isn't it? That
Yeah, well, I think they probably didn't realise the significance of his work at the time. So, yeah, that's why he and Frisch were sort of having these ideas and looking at things.
In the nucleus of the atom, positively charged protons and neutrally charged neutrons are wedded together by immensely powerful and invisible forces. Swirling around them are layers of negatively charged electrons. A couple of years previously, Frisch had already proven with his aunt, the renowned physicist Lise Meitner, that by bombarding the large and unstable uranium atom with neutrons, it was possible to split its nucleus. They called it nuclear fission. And like a cue ball crashing into a mass of other balls, more neutrons fire off, splitting more atoms, releasing more neutrons. With every spitting atom, the most powerful forces that hold the physical world together are unleashed in an explosive chain reaction. But all the calculations suggest it would take hundreds, if not thousands, of tons of uranium to create a bomb. It would be completely impractical. Turning the theory into an actual atomic weapon remains a pipe dream that's more like something from the fiction books of H.G. Wells. Nobody thinks it's going to be of any real relevance to the war effort. But Piles and Frisch are still jumpy.
When they were working on this, the physics department in Birmingham were in these Nissen huts in the grounds of the university. And the window was open, and then they heard someone outside. They heard a noise outside, so they were concerned that maybe somebody was spying on them. So they closed the window, and it turned out it was someone working on the garden outside, a gardener working outside the building.
Piles and Frisch have reason to be nervous. They realise that the atomic bomb need no longer remain in the realm of science fiction. Their research leads them to an explosive conclusion. In March 1940, they write a top-secret memorandum saying
that the release of what they called a super bomb would be equal to 1,000 tons of dynamite. And this super bomb would be very small, maybe not much bigger than 1 pound of material. And it would produce temperatures as high as the interior of the sun and could destroy life in a wide area, perhaps as large as the center of a big city. So this was an incredible discovery.
If they're right, the implications are huge. The atomic bomb is feasible and can be made with only small amounts of uranium. Their mathematical calculations are actually beautifully simple. Any PhD maths candidate worth their salt could have come to the same conclusion. But Frisch and Piles just happened to be asking the right question at the right time. In the same month Rudolf Piles makes this landmark discovery, he's granted his naturalisation papers. But for Klaus Fuchs, the sands are shifting under his feet. In September 1939, Germany invades Poland and Britain declares war.
I have to tell you now, this country is at war with Germany.
The government stops processing all applications, and overnight, Fuchs turns from refugee into enemy alien. A month later, personal tragedy strikes. His sister Elizabeth is boarding a train with their father Emil back in Germany. She has bouts of extreme depression. Her father can sense that she's unsettled, and he holds her hand as they board the train. When the train is gathering steam, there's a jolt. Emil stumbles and steadies himself. When he looks around, Elizabeth is gone, and the door is open. She's jumped. Her lifeless body is retrieved at the bottom of the deep ravine. Elizabeth, Klaus's sister, is the eighth in a line of women in the family who've killed themselves, including their mother 8 years previously. It's hard, if not impossible, to imagine what impact this has on Klaus Fuchs, and it's something he never spoke about.
Nächste Station, Wilhelmshaven. das Haken. Achtung, Türen können automatisch öffnen.
I've come to Berlin to meet the one person who can have any real insight on this. Elizabeth's son and Klaus's namesake, Klaus Fuchs-Katowski.
Hello. Hello. Yeah. And I have to show you something at the beginning.
Oh, sure.
After his mother killed herself, he was raised by his grandfather, Elizabeth and Klaus's father, Emil. His words are spoken by an actor.
My father was imprisoned when I was 1 year old. My mother died as a consequence of fascist terror when I was 4 years old. From then on, Emil Fuchs was both father and mother to me. Since I never missed a father or a mother, it shows what a special personality he was.
In 1931, as fascism was taking root in Germany, Klaus Fuchs's own mother told her husband Emil, "What comes now, I can no longer bear with you." Days later, Elizabeth found her writhing on the floor in agony after having drunk acid.
I don't know about the influence of his mother's death on him, but I am very sure that the death of my mother contributed to the hatred. For that, you need to know that my mother was active in the resistance, especially when my father was imprisoned and worked on a ship on the River Elbe, and my mother swam several times to the ship in order to give him money. That was very courageous and demanded a lot of strength, as the ship was under surveillance. It was arranged when he would escape from prison. And then he didn't come to the appointment. So my mother had to assume that the escape failed, and she committed suicide.
Fuchs is in Edinburgh when he learns of his sister's death. I imagine that this news must have brought back the pain and grief of his mother's suicide.
When you know the whole background, that his mother's suicide was a result of the whole fascist terror, then it is clear that the hatred, not against Germany, but against German fascism, was reinforced.
Fuchs never spoke of either of their suicides, but on forms, he simply put the cause of death, political reasons. His anti-fascist fervour is not just ideological, it's deeply personal. As he grapples with the tragic news from Germany, the Nazis are sweeping across Europe. Invasion of the British mainland has become a real threat. Hysteria over Nazi traitors and Nazi sympathisers gathers steam. On May 10th, 1940, German troops attack Belgium and Holland. And that night, the bullish Winston Churchill replaces the conciliatory Neville Chamberlain as Prime Minister. In one of his first acts in office, he orders the internment of every male enemy alien between 16 and 60 from the vulnerable East Coast, where a Nazi invasion is feared. Klaus Fuchs's fate is sealed. On the day of his departure, Fuchs writes a letter in scribbled and frenetic handwriting to his friend and mentor, Max Born.
I have little hope to see Edinburgh again and must try to express in a few rushed words all I owe you during the time I have been with you. I think you will understand without me saying much about it. I find it hard to cut away from a country I have learned to love, especially at such a time, and until the last moment I hope that it may not be necessary. But there is no point in deluding myself.
Born himself has only just escaped internment. His naturalisation papers had been processed before the outbreak of war, but Fuchs's departure comes as a personal blow. He writes in dismay to his wife, "Fanaticism versus fanaticism, belief versus belief. The distortion and repression of truth is raised to a political art." For Klaus Fuchs, the internment of committed anti-fascists simply confirms his suspicions of the Brits' real goal.
Not to establish freedom and democracy, but to continue to attempt shameful compromises with the Nazis.
His fear is that the British elite feels so threatened by communism that they might be willing to cut a deal with Hitler. This is early in the Second World War. Loyalties are still being formed. Trusts are still being built. Fuchs doesn't believe the British government is committed to anti-fascism. Whose side were they really on? His internment only serves to reinforce his beliefs about the British government's half-hearted anti-fascist convictions.
There were people in the British government who did not want to do this and did not think it was necessary. But one of the cabinet members said in a meeting, once a German, always a German. So that was their attitude. And Churchill was one of the people behind this.
In their haste, the government bundled together an explosive mix of foreign Jews, leftists, and Nazi prisoners of war.
And some of them had been in concentration camps in Germany. So when they heard they were going to an internment camp, you know, they didn't know what to expect. And some of them committed suicide. They couldn't stand it. And they committed suicide because they'd already been there. So it was a horrible situation.
But by midsummer 1940, Fuchs knows the tide has turned. When the police knock on his door, he is packed and ready to go. He just doesn't know where to. He soon finds out as he climbs down into the bowels of the SS Ettrick.
The Nazis were on one side and the internees were on the other. Now, most of the internees were Jewish, and the Nazis knew that also. So it was horrific. There were a few light bulbs, you know, hanging from the ceiling. The internees were given hammocks that they could hang up. There weren't enough for all of them. So many of them were making their beds on the floor.
Klaus Fuchs stoically embraces his situation, but the conditions around him below deck are appalling.
You know, it was stinking, it was close, it was horrible. The door was covered with several rounds of barbed wire, and at night it was locked.
While listening to the rumbling engines and fearing a torpedo strike from a Nazi U-boat at any moment, one of the internees writes a diary.
A sight worse than anything I've ever seen confronts me. The toilets. The peace fires are choked and filled with vomit. Vomit everywhere on the walls, on the doors, on the handles, simply everywhere. Here, the portholes are open, but each one is occupied by someone whose body is thrown into violent spasms at intervals. All this is accompanied by groans. This trip is turning into a nightmare. Never have I seen such conditions. People are desperate with pain and grief.
After a torturous week, somebody spots two birds and a long dark shape on the horizon. The coast of Canada. 2 days later, the men are summoned up onto the deck at 10 a.m. for the morning roll call. The sun streams down as tugboats guide them into dock, past the fortress-like Chateau Frontenac Hotel in Quebec.
Come on, move along, move it!
Bedraggled and emaciated, they finally disembark. But there's a problem. The Canadians have no way of knowing who is a Nazi, a Jew, or a communist. The vetting process was too cumbersome, too much hassle, so the Brits just didn't bother. As far as the Canadians are aware, they're dealing with Britain's most dangerous refugees and prisoners of war. For zealous anti-fascists such as Klaus Fuchs, the irony is not lost, so they label themselves His Majesty's loyal enemy aliens. The men are boarded onto buses and transferred to a hastily constructed camp on the heights overlooking the city. Double rows of barbed wire and sentry posts with machine guns encircle rows of grey wooden huts. Finally, after 17 hours since anything has passed their lips, the men savour their first meal. A slice of bread, a slab of gelatinous beef, and a desperately needed glass of water. And it's here, in the camp overlooking Quebec, that Fuchs meets a man who will change the direction of his life. Groups naturally form among the internees, and one of the cliques is the communists.
A person by the name of Hans Kahler was in charge of the communist group. Now, Kahler was a very impressive person. He was a soldier by his profession. He had fought in the Spanish Civil War. He had become fairly good friends with Ernest Hemingway during that time. And he was mentioned, and Hemingway wrote, For Whom the Bell Tolls, there is a general who is mentioned who supposedly Kahler was the prototype for.
Through the layers of barbed wire, they can see children playing tennis, families picnicking in the sun, and lovers flirting under the shade of the trees. It's a painful reminder of the lives and loves they've left behind. In the camp, Carla and Fuchs form a refugee committee. Carla is boss, and Klaus Fuchs, his devout deputy. They craft a sign from sackcloth, which reads in French and English, "We are refugees from Nazi oppression," and they hang it for passers-by to see. They have regular committee meetings, and time and again, he proves adept at rallying the internees to pressure the camp authorities.
I think they created a very strong bond, and I think that Koller had a profound effect on him.
So Koller's another sort of charismatic person with very strong beliefs who Klaus is impressed by.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's interesting. And was Koller a talent spotter?
Yes, he actually, his real job was with the Russian military intelligence. And I think he was recruiting.
Wow. Back in the UK, the scientific community lobby the government for Fuchs to be released from internment. And after 6 months, they succeed. He bids farewell to his friends and comrades in the camp, including Carla. They part ways, but this isn't the last time we'll meet Hans Carla in this story. Shortly after his return to England, Fuchs will be headhunted for a project on the front line of science and history. While Klaus Fuchs had been doggedly hounding the camp authorities in Canada or giving lectures on quantum physics to fellow internees, Rudolf Piles had been fretting over the implications of his discovery. When he wrote his memo with Otto Frisch, they didn't only say the atomic bomb was possible, but also that the bomb will be practically irresistible. The bomb will be definitive. Whoever has the bomb wins the war. Jo Hookway is Rudolf Piles' daughter.
He was very concerned about it because he felt that the Germans were very likely to be doing the similar kind of work.
Mm.
And so felt it was really important that the British got there first, so there would be it would be used as a deterrent as much as anything else.
The British government establishes a committee of its top nuclear scientists to investigate the feasibility of building a bomb. It concludes not only that the bomb is possible, but that it is essential for the war effort. With the weight of the British government now fully behind him, Piles understands the scale of what lies ahead of him. He needs a brilliant assistant, a physicist of the first order with a meticulous mind and a gift for problem solving.
And he was very, very impressed by Klaus Fuchs's ability to do calculations. He was very impressed with his physics.
Mm.
He felt that he had the skills that my father needed. So he was very keen to get him to join his group.
Fuchs has hardly hit dry land when he receives an invitation to join Rudolf Piles on a top-secret project at Birmingham University. But Piles isn't the only person wanting Klaus's help. On a trip to London, Klaus hooks up with some old friends. A party is in full swing at the Free German League of Culture in Hampstead, North London. And one of the guests is my great-uncle, Jürgen Kaczynski.
This was an organization that Jürgen Kaczynski had started along with a few other people in 1939. It had a lot of communists and a lot of social democrats, and there was kind of this mix, and they all knew each other, you know, and it was a large group of people who went there for cultural events. There was a library, there was a cafe, there were rooms for speaking, rooms for having parties.
But Fuchs isn't just here to socialize.
He went to Jürgen, he told him he wanted to spy. Or maybe didn't use those words. He wanted to give the Russians information that he had. He would not have called it a spy.
Jürgen isn't actually part of Soviet intelligence. He does, however, know who the spies are. Klaus Fuchs is introduced to a man called Alexander, a cover name for Simon Kramer, who's an agent for Soviet military intelligence. And Fuchs's old friend from internment, Soviet spy Hans Carla, is also in town, and he can vouch for the physicist's loyalty to the cause. Former KGB officer Alexander Vasiliev has researched the Soviet intelligence files on Fuchs.
Well, Klaus Fuchs came with very good recommendations from the German communists who lived in Britain at the time. They knew him as a good and devoted communist. So Klaus Fuchs was the perfect spy, actually, because on the one hand, he was a communist. On the other hand, he was a very private person. He didn't talk much. He was extremely disciplined. He was perfect.
And crucially, he became a spy of his own volition. Within a month of establishing contact with Soviet intelligence, Klaus Fuchs formally accepts the job of Piles in Birmingham. And his work with both Kramer and Piles suddenly takes on a whole new level of urgency. In June 1941, Hitler invades Russia, and more than 4 million Nazi soldiers push east in the biggest mobilisation of fighters in the history of warfare. But to the German military's surprise, Russia doesn't crumble. Although Russia reels from the onslaught, sustained resistance is not guaranteed. Stalin pleads with Churchill to divide German forces by opening up a second front. Britain is technically at war with Germany, but on the European mainland, they're no threat to Hitler. Churchill talks a tough game.
Hitler is a monster of wickedness, insatiable in his lust for blood and plunder. So now this bloodthirsty gutter snipe must launch his mechanized armies upon new fields of slaughter, pillage and devastation.
But the Second Front does not materialize. For Fuchs, this once again confirms his belief that the Brits aren't serious about fighting fascism. He sees a ploy to get the Russians and Germans to bleed each other dry. And yet Klaus Fuchs commits in earnest to helping the Brits build an atomic bomb. His old friend and mentor Max Born understands and sympathises with his political convictions. He advises Fuchs to steer clear of the atomic project. Born is a pacifist and understands the hugely destructive potential of this doomsday weapon. An atomic bomb in the hands of the capitalist powers is not a venture he thinks Fuchs wants to be part of. But for Fuchs, the defeat of the Nazis is paramount.
And so the illusion of a neutral or value-free society died overnight with a serious question that also required me to make a personal decision. Would the power be used for good or evil? How great is the danger of Hitler's fascism? How great are the dangers of this frightening weapon in a world torn apart?
In that world torn apart, the decisions he makes and the loyalties he commits to start to fracture his life in ways even he cannot predict. He started a chain reaction that threatens to blow up not only his own life, but the lives of the people closest to him. Will he be able to keep it under control? Next time on The Bomb.
You don't keep lists of people's names. Everyone has a code name. You keep moving around at night. You can't stay for very long in the same place.
Fuchs is getting very integrated into the Tube Alloys project very, very quickly, long before MI5 ever give him a security clearance.
People in Moscow are going crazy because they lost him.
You can subscribe to The Bomb on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd leave a rating or a review to help other people find it. The Bomb was presented by me, Rosa Ellis. It was written and produced by Zach Brophy. The story editor was Emma Harding. Alice McKee was the assistant producer. Klaus Fuchs was played by Marcus Calvin. And Klaus Kutowski by Wolf Kahler. With additional performances by David Hounslow. Sound design was by Tim Nielsen at Skywalker Sound and Eloise Whitmore. Original music was composed by Trevor Gorekis, with additional original music by Ben Marshall. The executive producer was Glyn Tansley, and the podcast was commissioned by Simon Pitts at the BBC World Service.